Now that you too must shortly go by Eleanor Fargent, it's her thoughts on hearing that Edward Thomas had been called up. Now that you too must shortly go the way which in these bloodshot years uncounted men have gone in vanishing armies, day by day, and in their numbers, will not come again. I must not strain the moments of our meeting, striving for each look, each accent, not to miss or question of our parting and our greeting. Is this the last of all? Is this or this? Last sight of all, it may be with these eyes. Last touch, last hearing. Since eyes, hands and ears, even serving love, are our mortalities, and cling to what they own in mortal fears. But oh, let end what will. I hold you fast by immortal love, which has no first or last.
The Zonnebeker Road by Edmund Blunden, reflecting events in September 1917 at Ypres. Morning, if this late withered light can claim some kindred with that merry flame, which young day was wont to fling through space. Agony stares from each grey face, and yet the day is come. Stand down, stand down. Your hands unclasp from rifles while you can. The frost has pierced them to the bended bone. Why, see old Stevens there, that iron man, melting the ice to shave his grotesque chin. Go ask him, shall we win? I never likes this bay. Some foolish fear caught me the first time that I came here. That dugout fallen in awakes, perhaps, some formless haunting of some corpse's chaps. True. And wherever we have held the line, there were such corners seeming saturnine for no good cause. Now, where the Haymarket starts, there is no place for soldiers with weak hearts. The Minnenwerfers have it to the inch. Look how the snow dust whisks along the road, piteous and silly, and the stones themselves must flinch in this east wind. The low sky, like a load, hangs over, a dead weight. But what a pain must gnaw where its clay cheek crushes the shell-chopped trees that fang the plain. The ice-bound throat gulps out a gargoyle shriek. That wretched wire before the village line rattles like rusty brambles on the dead bine. And there the daylight oozes into dun. Black pillars! Those are trees where roadways run. Even Ypres would warm our souls. Fond fool, our tours but one night old, seven more to cool. Oh, screaming dumbness, oh, dull clashing death, shreds of dead grass and willows, homes and men, watch as you will. Men clench their chattering teeth and freeze you back with that one hope, disdain.
Punch in the Enemy's Trenches by Owen Seaman. Thoughts of the Punch magazine's editor regarding the Christmas 1914 unofficial ceasefire. To the officer whose letter reproduced in the Daily Telegraph, after reporting the irregular exchange of Christmas gifts between our men and the enemy, goes on to say, in order to put a stop to the situation which was proving impossible, I went out myself, after a time, with a copy of Punch, which I presented to a dingy Saxon in exchange for a small packet of excellent cigars and cigarettes. A sense of truce was in the air, and mutual compliments were paid. A sausage here, a mince pie there, in lieu of bomb and hand grenade. And foes forgot that Christmastide. Their business was to kill the other side. There, not to feel the passion of overcoming, the pulsing beat of hearts that strive for right. Theirs, but to live while fears, like wild birds homing, come through the shadows of each sleepless night. Theirs not to know where loved ones' feet are marching, where darling heads are pillowed far away. Theirs but to look towards heaven's great spaces arching, to breathe in loneliness, dear names, and pray. There to stand fast, a might trust safekeeping. Theirs to flinch never, though hard paths be trod. Theirs to hold high hope's lamp o'er woe and weeping. Theirs duty nobly done, the rest with God.
Trench Idyll by Richard Aldington. From his collection Images of War, published in 1919. We sat together in the trench, he on a lump of frozen earth blown in the night before, I on an unexploded shell, and smoked and talked like exiles of how pleasant London was, its women, restaurants, nightclubs, theatres. How, at that very hour, the taxi cabs were taking folk to dine. Then we sat silent for a while as a machine gun swept the parapet. He said,
I've been here on and off 2 years and only seen one man killed.
That's odd.
The bullet hit him in the throat. He fell in a heap on the fire step and called out, My God!
Good Lord, how terrible. Well, as to that, the nastiest job I've had was last year on this very front, taking the discs at night from men who'd hung 6 months on the wire, just over there. The worst of all was they fell to pieces at a touch. Thank God we couldn't see their faces. They had gas helmets on.
I shivered. It's rather cold here, sir. Suppose we move? Break of Day in the Trenches by Isaac Rosenberg, from Trench Poems, written in 1916 and published in 1922. The darkness crumbles away. It's the same old druid time as ever. Only a live thing leaps my hand, a queer sardonic rat, as I pull the parapet's poppy to stick behind my ear. Droll rat, they would shoot you if they knew your cosmopolitan sympathies. Now you have touched this English hand, you will do the same to a German soon, no doubt. If it be your pleasure to cross the sleeping green between, it seems you inwardly grin as you pass. Strong eyes, fine limbs, hurt the athletes, less chance than you for life. Bonds to the whims of murder, sprawled in the bowels of the earth, the torn fields of France. What do you see in our eyes? At the shrieking iron and flame hurled through still heavens, what quaver, what heart aghast? Poppies, whose roots are in man's veins, drop and are ever dropping. But mine, is safe in my ear, just a little white with the dust.
A Working Party by Siegfried Sassoon, dated the 30th of March 1916 during his first tour of the trenches. 3 hours ago, he blundered up the trench, sliding and poising, groping with his boots. Sometimes he tripped and lurched against the walls with hands that poured the sodden bags of chalk. He couldn't see the man who walked in front. Only he heard the drum and rattle of feet, stepping along barred trench boards, often splashing wretchedly where the sludge was ankle deep. Voices would grunt, "Keep to the right, make way," when squeezing past some men from the front line. White faces peered, puffing a point of red. Candles and braziers glinted through the chinks and curtain flaps of dugouts, and then the gloom swallowed his sense of sight. He stooped and swore because a sagging wire had caught his neck. A flare went up. The shining whiteness spread and flickered upward, showing nimble rats and mounds of glimmering sandbags bleached with rain. Then the slow silver moment died in dark. The wind came posting by with chilly gusts and buffeting at the corners, piping thin and dreary through the crannies. Rifle shots would split and crack and sing along the night, and shells came calmly through the drizzling air to burst with hollow bang below the hill. 3 hours ago, he stumbled up the trench. Now he will never walk that road again. He must be carried back, a jolting lump beyond all needs of tenderness and care. He was a young man with a meagre wife and 2 small children in a Midland town. He showed their photographs to all his mates, and they considered him a decent chap, who did his work and hadn't much to say, and always laughed at other people's jokes because he hadn't any of his own. That night, when he was busy at his job of piling bags along the parapet, he thought how slow time went, stamping his feet and blowing on his fingers pinched with cold. He thought of getting back by 12:30, a tot of rum to send him warm to sleep in draughty dugout, frousty with the fumes of coke and full of snoring, weary men. He pushed another bag along the top, craning his body outward. Then a flare gave one white glimpse of no man's land and wire, and as he dropped his head, the instant split his startled life with lead, and all went out.
The Other Side by Gilbert Franco, and this is the part of a much longer poem, it being a letter from Major Average of the Royal Field Artillery in Flanders, acknowledging a presentation copy of a book of war verse written by a former subaltern of his battery, who was now in England. "Just got your letter and the poems, thanks. You always were a brainy sort of chap, though pretty useless as a subaltern. Too much imagination. Not enough of that rare quality of sound common sense. And so you managed to get on the staff. Influence, I suppose. A captain, too. How do the tabs suit you? Are they blue or green? About your boo, I've read it carefully. So has McFadden. You remember him, the light-haired chap who joined us after Lewes? And candidly, we don't think much of it. The piece about the horses isn't bad, but all the rest, excuse the word, are tripe. The same old tripe we've read 1,000 times. My grief! But we're fed up to the back teeth with war books, war verse, all the eyewash stuff that seems to please the idiots back home. You know the kind of thing we're used to. Heroes who laugh while Fritz is strafing them. They don't remember that you found it fun the day they shelled us out of Blauport Farm. After the fight, our cheery wounded note the smile of victory. It won't come off. Of course they smile. So'd you if you'd escaped and saw 3 months of hospital ahead. They don't smile much when they're shipped back to France.
September the 25th, 1916, by F.W.D. Bendel. Describing events during the Battle of Thiepval Ridge. I sat upon the fire step, by my side the adjutant, next to him an FOO. The trench was a German one, reversed. The parapet was made of things that should not have been there at all. The time was 0-20, and the noise that had been horrible enough before grew to an unimaginable pitch. It seemed as though I had no eye, no mouth, no sense of sight or taste, no power of speech, but only hearing. Hearing multiplies to the last limit of a dizzy brain. The noise was everywhere about, but mostly above us, and was made of every sort of bang, crash, whistle, whine, thump, shriek, and thud. If every devil from the pit of hell, each with an unmelodious instrument, each vying with the other in making noise, had flown above me in the tortured air, one great infernal pandemonium, I do not think they would have made a tenth of the long seismic polyphony that passed over our heads. I saw the adjutant's mouth open and his lips move as in speech, but no words came that I could hear because my hearing was entirely occupied. The trench wall rocked, the dust and clods of earth fell all about me, and I was aware of fat grey smoke wreaths and acrid smell. And dimly, as one hears a metronome in punctuating stabs of sharper sound through a great orchestral symphony, I heard the German counter barrage burst on the high ground about us and saw my watch making 3 minutes past the 0 hour. Sat for another unremembered space, wondering what would happen if a shell fell in the trench beside me, and felt again, by some sixth sense rather than through my ears, that there were fewer shells, that they had ceased. Climbing on the parapet and north by east from the torn hill of Glinchy Telegraph, saw, I, and seeing, cheered exultantly the long, well-ordered lines of our advance from Bulow Wood to distant Gaudicourt, sweep from the valley underneath my feet up the long slopes to Morale and Les Boeufs.
The Soldier by Rupert Brooke. Written on leave at Christmas 1914, when he was on leave, and read at St. Paul's Cathedral on Easter Sunday 1915, 19 days before Brooke's death on the 23rd of April. If I should die, think only this of me, that there's some corner of a foreign field that is forever England. There shall be in that rich earth a richer dust concealed, a dust whom England bore, shaped, made aware, gave once her flowers to love, her ways to roam, a body of England's, breathing English air, washed by rivers, blessed by suns of home. And think, this heart, all evil shed away, a pulse in the eternal mind, no less gives somewhere back the thoughts by England given, her sights and sounds, dreams happy as her day, and laughter learnt of friends, and gentleness in hearts at peace under an English heaven.
Who Made the Law? By Leslie Coulson. This poem was found amongst his possessions after he was killed on the Somme in October 1916. Who made the law that men should die in meadows? Who spake the word that blood should splash in lanes? Who gave it forth that gardens should be boneyards? And who spread the hills with flesh and blood and brains? Who made the law? Who made the law that death should stalk the village? Who spake the word to kill among the sheaves? Who gave it forth that death should lurk in hedgerows? And who flung the dead among the fallen leaves? Who made the law? Those who return shall find peace that endures. Find old things old and know the things they knew. Walk in the garden, slumber by the fireside, share the peace of dawn and dream amid the dew. Those who return. Those who return shall till the ancient pastures. Clean-hearted men shall guide the plough-horse reins. Some shall grow apples and flowers in the valleys. Some shall go courting in summer down the lanes. Those who return. But who made the law? The trees shall whisper to him, "See, see the blood that splashes on our bark." Walking the meadows, he shall hear bones crackle, and fleshless mouths shall gibber in silent lanes at dark. Who made the law? Who made the law? At noon upon the hillside, his ears shall hear a moan, his cheeks shall feel a breath, and all along the valleys, past gardens, crofts, and homesteads, he who made the law, he who made the law, he who made the law shall walk along with death.
The Ballad of Army Pay by F. W. Harvey from Gloucestershire Friends Collection, published in 1917. In general, if you want a man to do a dangerous job, say swim the Channel, climb St. Paul's, or break into and rob the Bank of England, why? You find his wages must be higher than if you merely wanted him to fight the kitchen fire. But in the British Army, it's just the other way, and the maximum of danger means the minimum of pay. You put some men inside a trench and call them infantry and make them face 10 kinds of hell and face it cheerfully. And live in holes like rats with other rats and lice and toads. And in their leisure time, assist the REs with their loads. Then when they've done it all, you give them each a bob a day. For the maximum of danger means the minimum of pay. We won't run down the ASIC, nor yet the RTO. They ration and direct us on the way we've got to go. They're very useful people. And it's perfectly plain to see we couldn't do without them, nor yet the APC. But comparing risks and wages, I think they all will say that the maximum of danger means the minimum of pay. There are men who make munitions and 70 bob a week. They never see a lousy trench, nor hear a big shell shriek. and others sing about the war at high-class music halls, getting heaps and heaps of money and encores from the stalls. They keep the home fires burning and bright by night and day, while the maximum of danger means the minimum of pay. I wonder if it's harder to make big shells at a bench than to face the screaming beggars when they're crumping up a trench. I wonder if it's harder to sing in mellow tones of danger than to face it, say in a wood like Trones. Is discipline skilled labour or something children play? Should the maximum of danger mean the minimum of pay?
I Have a Rendezvous with Death by Alan Seeger. From his poems, published in 1917. I have a rendezvous with death at some disputed barricade. When spring comes back with rustling shade and apple blossoms fill the air, I have a rendezvous with death when spring brings back blue days and fair. It may be he shall take my hand and lead me into his dark land and close my eyes and quench my breath. It may be I shall pass him still, but I have a rendezvous with death on some scarred slope of battered hill when spring comes round again this year and first meadow flowers appear. God knows 'twere better to be deep pillowed in silk and scented down, where love throbs out in blissful sleep, pulse nigh to pulse and breath to breath, where hushed awakenings are dear. But I've a rendezvous with death at midnight in some flaming town, when spring trips north again this year, and I to my pledged word am true, I shall not fail that rendezvous.
Breakfast by Wilfred Wilson Gibson from the poetry collection Battle, published in 1915. We ate our breakfast lying on our backs because the shells were screeching overhead. I bet a rasher to a loaf of bread that all united would beat Halifax when Jimmy Stainthorpe played full back instead of Billy Bradford. Ginger raised his head and cursed and took the bet and dropped back dead. We ate our breakfast lying on our backs because the shells were screeching overhead.
The Silent One by Ivor Gurney, probably written during his stay at City of London Mental Hospital, Dartford. Who died on the wires and hung there, one of two? Who for his hours of life had chattered through infinite lovely chatter of Buck's accent, yet faced unbroken wires, stepped over, and went, a noble fool, faithful to his stripes, and ended. But I, weak, hungry, and willing only for the chance of line to fight in the line, lay down under unbroken wires and saw the flashes and kept unshaken, till the politest voice, a finicking accent, said, "Do you think you might crawl through there? There's a hole." Darkness shot at. I smiled and as politely replied, "I'm afraid not, sir." There was no hole, no way to be seen, nothing but chance of death after tearing of clothes. Kept flat and watched the darkness, hearing bullets whizzing, and thought of music. And swore deep hearts, deep oaths, polite to God, and retreated, and came on again, again retreated, and a second time faced the screen.
After the battle by A.P. Herbert, this poem first appeared in the New Statesman on the 30th of June, 1917. So, they are satisfied with our brigade, and it remains to parcel out the bays. And we shall have the usual thanks parade, the beaming general and the soapy praise. You will come in your capricious car to find your heroes sulking in the rain, to tell us how magnificent we are and how you hope we'll do the same again. And we, who knew your old abusive tongue, who heard you hector us a week before, we who have bled to boost you up a rung, a KCB perhaps, perhaps a corps, we who must mourn those spaces in the mess and somehow fill those hollows in the heart. We do not want your sermon on success, your greasy benisons on being smart. We only want to take our wounds away to some warm village where the tumult ends, and drowsing in the sunshine many a day, forget our aches, forget that we had friends. Weary are we of blood and noise and pain. This was a week we shall not soon forget, and if indeed we have to fight again, we little wish to think about it yet. We have done well. We like to hear it said. Say it, and then for God's sake say no more. Fight if you must, fresh battles far ahead, but keep them dark behind your chateau door.
The Dead Fox Hunter by Robert Graves. In memory of Captain A.L. Sampson and Battalion Royal Welsh Fusiliers killed near Quinchy, September the 25th, 1915. Written 25th of September, 1915, at the Battle of Loos. We found the little captain at the head. His men lay well aligned. We touched his hand, stone cold, and he was dead. And they, all dead behind, had never reached their goal, but they died well. They charged in line, and in the same line fell. The well-known rosy colours of his face were almost lost in grey. We saw that, dying and in hopeless case, for others' sake that day, he'd smothered all rebellious groans. In death, his fingers were tight clenched between his teeth. For those that live uprightly and die true, heaven has no bars or locks and serves all taste. Or what's for him to do up there but hunt the fox? Angelic choirs? No. Justice must provide for one who rode straight and in hunting died. So, if heaven had no hunt before he came, why, it must find one now. If any shirk and doubt they know the game, there's one to teach them how. And the whole host of seraphim complete must jog in scarlet to his opening meet.
R.I.P. by John Peterson. This was first published in his 1920 collection called Roads and Ditches. Lay them together in this muddy shell hole. Cover them over with this muddy sheet. Heed not their staring eyes. They gaze to starry skies. Wrap their red tartans around their poor feet. Cover them quickly, nor mutter a prayer. Pile on the earth, quick, with never a pang. Mark it another grave. Haste, every second save. Here, on this rifle, their tin helmets hang. High soar the night flares. Hush swift to your fire step. Leave then to rest there, out under the stars. Boys of the city bred, men of the tartan dead, laid in the lone waste by sad, dead Le Sars. So we leave you, lads, laid in the sheer waste, sleeping till summer shall flit o'er the foam, robed in her gold and blue, to clasp, caressing you close to her bosom, her own gathered home.
Out of Conflict by Alberta Vicarage. This was published in her 1919 collection, The Sea Gazer. The ward is strangely hushed today. The morning nurses, sober-eyed, recall the screened space where, they say, at midnight, number 20 died. So many weeks of weary hours he lay and heard our busy tread, as patient as the wistful flowers that spent their fragrance near his bed. So oft we saw in passing by his questing glance, his dreadful face. We shall regard resentfully the stranger that must fill his place. What vision wrapped him through the dim, slow hours? Like rays upon the sight, all common changes seemed to him of dawn and day, of eve and night. Each brought its sounds of whispering feet, its faces glimmering ghost by ghost. Yet scarce he left his dream to greet those comers who would mourn him most. For in his sight shone such a star as, after tempers loud and rude to sea-worn eyes, foretells some far relief, a port of quietude. And, homing to that bourne, he heard the call so many wanderers know, from meadows lulled by bee and bird, where he was happy long ago, where simple things were ecstasy, and life a game among the flowers, and every hurt and malady was healed by gentler hands than ours. Not Jacinth's wall and golden street, perchance, so wrapped his dying gaze. For him, heaven's wonder was the sweet, lost wonder of his childhood's days. Perchance, he sought no blissful shore, no place among the myriad blessed, but just to lay a child once more, his tired head on his mother's breast. Ah, well, today all dreams come true for those closed eyes where riddles cease. He leaves the warring world he knew and ratifies, ere we, his peace. God rest him then, but we must turn to face the same sad tasks again, to tend new convoys and discern the same dream in the eyes of pain.
Smile, Smile, Smile by Wilfred Owen. This is the final draft of Owen's last poem, dated the 23rd of September, 1918. Head to limp head, the sunk-eyed wounded scanned yesterday's mail. The casualties, typed small, and large, vast booty from our latest haul. Also, they read of cheap homes not yet planned. For, said the paper, when this war is done, the men's first instinct will be making homes. Meanwhile, their foremost need is aerodromes, it being certain war has just begun. Peace would do wrong to our undying dead. The sons we offered might regret they died if we got nothing lasting in their stead. We must be solidly indemnified. Though all be worthy, victory which all bought, We rulers sitting in this ancient spot would wrong our very selves. If we forgot, the greatest glory will be theirs, who fought, who kept this nation in integrity. Nation? The half-limbed readers did not chafe, but smiled at one another curiously, like secret men who know their secret safe. This is the thing they know and never speak, that England, one by one, had fled to France, not many elsewhere, now save under France. Pictures of these broad smiles appear each week, and people in whose voice real feeling rings say, how they smile, they're happy now. Poor thing.
My Boy Jack, written in 1915 by Rudyard Kipling. Published in the Daily Telegraph on the 18th of October 1916, a year after his son John was reported missing at Lewes. Have you any news of my boy Jack?
Not this tide.
When do you think he'll come back?
Not with this wind blowing and this tide.
Has anyone had word of him?
Not this tide. For what is sunk will hardly swim, not with this wind blowing and this tide.
Oh dear, what comfort can I find?
None this tide, nor any tide.
Except he did not shame his kind, not even with that wind blowing and that tide. Then hold your head up all the more.
This tide and every tide.
Because he was the son you bore and gave to that wind blowing and that tide.
To my brother, in memory of July the 1st, 1916, written by Vera Brittain. It was written 4 days before Edward Britain's death on June the 15th, 1918. Your battle wounds are scars upon my heart, received when in that grand and tragic show you played your part 2 years ago. And silver in the summer morning sun, I see the symbol of your courage glow. That cross that you won 2 years ago. Though now again you watch the shrapnel fly and hear the guns that daily louder grow as in July 2 years ago. May you endure to lead the last advance, and with your men pursue the flying foe as once in France 2 years ago.
The Menin Road, written in March 1919 by Carola Oman. This published in 1919 in the collection Menin Road and Other Poems. Over the flat dim land I see you moving methodically, under a dark wide sky full of low clouds. You are gone far from our loving, no fret of ours or grief can touch you now. The road speaks nothing of our longing now. The winds are to us and us by. The nameless tracks, the faded grass spread out as far as we can see. The homeless shadows glance and pass by shattered wood and naked tree. Splintered and stark, they rise alone against so wonderful a blue of distance and intensity at once so steadfast and so true. I wonder, are you wholly gone?
The Cenotaph by Charlotte Mew. This appeared in the Westminster Gazette on the 7th of September 1919, after the unveiling of Edward Lutyens' war memorial. Not yet will those measureless fields be green again. There only yesterday the wild sweet blood of wonderful youth was shed. There is a grave whose earth must hold too long, too deep a stain, though forever over it we may speak as proudly as we may tread. But here, where the watchers by lonely hearths, from the thrust of an inward sword, have more slowly bled, we shall build the cenotaph, victory winged with peace, winged too at the column's head, and over the stairway, at the foot, oh, here, leave, desolate, passionate hands to spread violets, roses, and laurel, with a small, sweet, tinkling country things, speaking so wistfully of other springs, from the little gardens and the little places where son or sweetheart was born and bred, in splendid sleep, with a thousand brothers, to lovers, to mothers, here too lies he. Under the purple, the green, the red, it is all young life. It must break some women's hearts to see such a brave, gay coverlet to such a bed. Only when all is done and said, God is not mocked, and neither are the dead. For this will stand in our marketplace. Who'll sell, who'll buy, will you or I lie each to each with a better grace? While looking into every busy whore's and huckster's face as they drive their bargains, is the face of God, and some young, hideous, murdered face.
In Memoriam, Easter 1915, by Edward Thomas. Written while at Yew Tree Cottage, Steep, Hampshire, in April 1915. The flowers left thick at nightfall in the wood this Eastertide call into mind the men, now far from home, who with their sweethearts should have gathered them and will do never again.